Hello and welcome. This is Michael Annis, and you're listening to episode 173 of the Space Rocket History Podcast. And now, Soyuz 4 and 5, World's First Space Station, Part 2. From the previous episode, we met the cosmonauts, learned the history of this flight, and discovered the final mission plan for Soyuz 4 and 5. And that plan was, cosmonaut Shatilov would ride alone into orbit on Soyuz 4 first. Soyuz 5 would be launched the next day, with Voronov commanding and Yelizaev and Krunov assigned to perform the spacewalk. Soyuz 4 and 5 would rendezvous and dock. Then Yelizaev and Krunov would spacewalk from Soyuz 5 to Soyuz 4 and remain there. Next, Soyuz 4 would return to Earth with the three cosmonauts, and then Voronov in Soyuz 5 would return to Earth as well. Now let's move on to the hardware used for the flights. The Soyuz 7K OK spacecraft was used for both Soyuz 4 and 5. Recall, the Soyuz 7K OK spacecraft was composed of three elements attached end to end: the orbit module, the descent module, and the instrumentation/propulsion module. The crew occupied the central element, called the descent module. The other two modules were jettisoned prior to re-entry. They were supposed to burn up in the atmosphere, so only the descent module returned to Earth. The Soyuz carrier rocket for both missions was the 11A511, a 1960s-era Soviet expendable rocket designed by OKB-1 and manufactured by the State Aviation Plant No. 1 in Kubushaev. The carrier rocket was used to launch Soyuz spacecraft as part of the Soyuz program, initially on unmanned test flights, followed by the first 19 manned launches of the program. It also had the capability to be used as a ballistic missile. This version of the Soyuz launcher was introduced in 1966. It was derived from the Vostok launcher, which in turn was based on the R-7 intercontinental ballistic missile. It was initially a three-stage rocket with a Block 1 upper stage. The new version introduced an uprated core stage and strap-on boosters, which became standard for all R-7-derived launch vehicles. Now, let's turn to the launch of Soyuz 4. Cosmonaut Vladimir Shatilov would become the Soviet Union's 13th spacefarer. His home telephone number ended in 13, and the launch itself was set for 1 p.m. Moscow time, which is 1300 hours, on January 13th, which also happened to be a Monday, which is traditionally regarded by Russians as a most difficult day of the week. Perhaps Shatilov anticipated a little bad luck during the days preceding his mission, but as it happened, Shatilov's only real bad luck transpired shortly after boarding Soyuz 4 on the morning of January 13th. Shatilov was part of the first launch scrub in Soviet space history. Despite temperatures of minus 24 degrees C and gusting winds, the fueling of the R-7 rocket proceeded normally, and Shatilov settled into the spacecraft and began running through his pre-launch systems checks. Minor irritations came in the form of voice communication dropouts whenever Soyuz 4's television camera was used, prompting it to be shut off. Then, with 9 minutes to go, a problem was detected within the R-7's gyroscopes, apparently related to the ambient temperature and humidity. By the time the problem was resolved, the launch time had slipped to mid-afternoon, and Shatilov had been lying on his back for over 2 hours. Moreover, with a mission whose planned duration was almost exactly 3 days, to launch at this time of day would produce a landing in the half light of a gloomy midwinter's afternoon on January 16th. This was far from ideal for such a complex flight. Ultimately, mission rules decided the outcome. Fuel temperatures could not fall below -2°C at night, or the loss of specific impulse would reduce the R7's thrust by more than 5%. The managers therefore opted to postpone the launch. Shatilov concealed his disappointment well. As he was extracted from the couch, he quipped that he had just set a new record for the world's shortest spaceflight and the very first to return to the exact point of liftoff. Years later, he admitted to an interviewer that despite the run of 13s, he was not an overly superstitious man. His quick wit, superstition, and disappointment aside, a number of potentially serious challenges remained. Although Soyuz had been designed to touch down on solid ground and was capable of performing a water landing, unmanned experience had shown that it might not be totally waterproof, and indeed could sink. The chances of either Soyuz 4 or 5 splashing down somewhere in the ice-covered Aral Sea were estimated at only 0.003%. But, erring on the side of caution, recovery forces dispatched rescue helicopters and a trio of B-12 seaplanes in readiness for such an eventuality. Finally, at 10:30 a.m. Moscow time on January 14th, Soyuz 4 had a perfect liftoff and insertion into a slight elliptical orbit with a perigee of 213 kilometers and an apogee of 224 kilometers. The inclination was 51.7 degrees and the period was 88.8 minutes. For Shatilov, the experience of the rocket launch, the weightlessness of space and the view of Earth were profound. This is how he described his experience. Quote, "When we look into the sky, it seems to us to be endless. We breathe without thinking about it, as is natural, and then you sit in a spacecraft. You tear away from Earth, and within 10 minutes you have been carried straight through the layer of air and beyond. There is nothing. The boundless blue sky, the ocean, which gives us breath and protects us from endless black, is but an infinitesimal thin film." Unquote. Shatilov described weightlessness at the post-flight press conference at Moscow State University. He said, quote, "It took me about 3 to 4 hours to master it." Unquote. Back on Earth, the Soyuz 5 trio of cosmonauts were watching the launch from Baikonur. Their turn would come the next morning, January 15th, when they were destined to blast off and adopt a passive role as Shatilov performed the world's first ever docking between two manned spacecrafts. A little more than 6 hours after launch, at 4:35 p.m., Shatilov adjusted Soyuz 4's orbit, showed television viewers his spacious descent module with two empty extra seats, and then retired into the orbital module for his first night's sleep in space. The next morning at 3 a.m., an AN-12 aircraft from Moscow touched down at Baikonur with an unusual cargo, 10 newspapers, and a batch of letters to be delivered to Shatilov by the Soyuz 5 crew in the world's first space mail service. It was yet another effort by the Soviets to generate a space spectacular. Several hours later, the crew took their places in the spacecraft, where Voronov assumed the center seat, flanked by flight engineer Yelizaev and research engineer Krunov. Shortly after 9:30 a.m., with barely 25 minutes to go before launch, a piece of electrical equipment failed, and it looked as if another scrub might occur. Normally, the equipment could only be replaced by lowering the rocket into a horizontal position. But despite the fully fueled state of the R7 booster and the freezing temperature, engineer Captain Victor Alyashin stripped off most of his clothes and squeezed through a narrow hatch into the rocket's bowels to correct the problem. He also noticed that the crew access hatch in the aerodynamic shroud was secured by only 3 bolts instead of 4. Nonetheless, at 10:04 a.m. Moscow time on January 15th, Soyuz 5 roared aloft and a few minutes later was precisely inserted into orbit, trailing Shatilov by some 1,207 kilometers. Although Voronov executed a thrust firing later that day to further refine his orbital parameters, his craft would remain essentially passive during the rendezvous. To Krunov, the first view of Earth was like a jewel of the most intense blue, flecked by white cloud, glimmering in the ethereal blackness of space. The feeling, he said later, was like those final euphoric seconds before embarking on a parachute jump, or the sensation felt by an adrenaline-charged athlete about to perform the stunt of his lifetime. In addition to the joint program with Soyuz 4, the crew had their own specific agenda. Yelizaev was assigned geological and geographical work, and Krunov would be occupied with medical and ionospheric radio propagation experiments. Krunov would also play a key role in the final stages of rendezvous by operating the ship's onboard sextant. By mid-morning on January 15th, all 4 of the cosmonauts, Shatilov, Voronov, Yelizaev, and Krunov, were in orbit. As radio chatter crackled between the 2 Soyuz and ground control, their call signs were revealed as Amur for Shatilov and Baikal for Voronov's crew. The 2 Soyuz established mutual radio contact shortly after Soyuz 5 reached space. On the next day, January 16th, at 8:06 a.m., Shatilov made his final orbital adjustment in preparation for the rendezvous. At that point, Shatilov in Soyuz 4 was partway through his 34th orbit, and Voronov, Yelizaev, and Krunov in Soyuz 5 were on their 18th revolution. At 10:37 a.m., high above the South Pacific, Shatilov switched on his EGLA device to begin the automated rendezvous. The rendezvous ended over Africa at 11:05 a.m. when the separation between the 2 crafts was just 40 meters. Speaking after the mission, Shatilov recalled that his most important aids during this critical period were his instruments and his own eyes. At 40 meters, he said, Boris Voronov and he performed several maneuvers in the course of which we changed the relative position of the spacecraft. Further approach and docking were performed within the zone of direct TV contact with the ground stations. To avoid sharp contact with each other, the relative speed of approach was reduced to several centimeters per second. Contact itself came at 11:20 a.m. as Soyuz 4 and 5 flew above the Yevpatorial Control Center in the Crimea. Now that we have docked, let's move on to the spacewalk. The spacesuits worn by the 2 cosmonauts during their daring ship-to-ship transfer were quite different from the one worn by Alexei Leonov during his spacewalk in March of 1965, which was covered in episodes 55 and 56. On that occasion, the burr cut or golden eagle ensemble was stiff and it ballooned dangerously as Leonov tried to re-enter the airlock, and by the time he returned inside the Voskhod 2 cabin, he was drenched in sweat, breathing hard and exhausted. By contrast, the Yastreb or Hawk suit of Yelizaev and Krunov were more flexible, benefiting from a complex array of lines and pulleys for dexterity, and their life support and environmental control units could be worn on either their chest or shins to help them get through the small hatch of the Soyuz orbital module. The spacewalk required a considerable amount of self-awareness and demanded every ounce of energy and stamina that Krunov and Yelizaev could muster. Although Boris Volyanov was on hand to assist them for a while, checking their life support and communications gear, and helping them to secure their gloves, the time inevitably came for him to retire to his couch in Soyuz 5's descent module, seal the hatch, and depressurize the orbital module. It was with this experience, and more than 2 years of preparation under their belts, that at 12:43 p.m. Moscow time on January 16, 1969, Krunov and Yelizaev finished donning their spacesuits and began the greatest engineering challenge and the biggest thrill of their lives. Krunov was the first man out. He swung open the hatch and floated into the void barely an hour after the docking. The spacewalker's departure was not entirely trouble-free. One of Krunov's oxygen hoses became entangled, and he accidentally closed the tumbler of the suit's ventilator. Although he succeeded in freeing it and solved the problem, the need to help his partner distracted Yelizaev, who forgot to install a movie camera outside the hatch. As a result, the world was denied film of the spacewalk and had to make do with a poor quality video transmission. Yet Krunov and Yelizaev's spacewalk was an impressive feat. By 1:30 p.m., both men were inside Soyuz 4's orbital module, the hatch of which had been automatically cranked open by Shatilov, and then they assumed their new places in the descent module. Not too surprisingly, no evidence of any of these problems appeared in either cosmonaut's official recollections. In fact, Yelizaev's failure to set up the movie camera was saved by Krunov, who assembled a still camera inside Soyuz 4 orbital module. This camera only yielded a few grainy images from the joint mission. Still, both men told a press conference at Moscow State University on January 24 that their Yastreb spacesuit had performed well, the ventilators and heat exchangers worked effectively, and they experienced no fogging of their visors from condensation. This is how Krunov described his spacewalk. He found that the easiest way to move in space was a hand-over-hand progression using rails attached to both spacecraft. He said, quote, "Moving along the rails in this way, I approached the camera. Then, gripping the rail with one hand, I removed the camera from the bracket and disconnected it from the onboard electric mains. Then, walking on hands in the same manner, I moved along the outer surface of the assembled space station and entered the compartment of Soyuz 4. End quote. Krunov's misleading reference to the combination as a space station was endorsed by Yelizaev, who went further by stressing that, quote, "The choice of the method of transfer through open space rather than by means of a tunnel was not an accidental one." End quote. Not everyone in the Western world was fooled. Time magazine pondered the Soviet space station ambitions, But American astronaut Deke Slayton, for one, remained skeptical. In his autobiography entitled Deke, Slayton pointed out that the space station comparison was sort of a stretch and speculated that the Soviets were simply trying to upstage Apollo 9, an American rendezvous, docking, and crew transfer flight scheduled for launch several weeks later. On the Apollo mission, however, crew members were to transfer internally between their two spacecraft. Time magazine further pondered about future Soviet space plans by asking the question, would this four-compartment version lead next to a roomy orbiting laboratory? Many observers, though, had a more fundamental question, as Flight International pointed out on January 23rd, quote, "It is not clear whether cosmonauts can traverse from one vehicle to another through a tunnel joining the two vehicles," end quote. Now, this was the crux of the debate over whether Soyuz 4 and 5 represented a true space station. Left unsaid by the Soviet news agency TASS was the reality that those four rooms, the two orbital modules and two descent modules, though electrically and mechanically mated, did not permit internal transfer from one spacecraft to the other. At 3:55 p.m. Moscow time, 4 hours and 35 minutes after docking, the two spacecraft separated and Shatilov, in his Soyuz 4, fired its thrusters to pull away. The next morning, Shatilov initiated reentry, and he, Yelizaev, and Krunov descended through a wintry blizzard and thumped onto the snowy Kazakh steep at 9:53 a.m., located southwest of the coal mining city of Karaganda. Shatilov, whose performance during the rendezvous and docking was later described as exemplary, became the first cosmonaut to maintain a running commentary during the ballistic fall to Earth using a VHF antenna embedded in the hatch of the descent module. At the instant of touchdown, Shatilov had spent a little less than 3 days in space, while Yelizaev and Krunov concluded missions of almost 48 hours apiece. Despite landing in a blizzard with 24 to 30 inches of snow on the ground and temperatures of minus 37 degrees C, all three men were safe and were picked up by helicopter within minutes. Only one item remained to complete the mission: the return of Voronov in Soyuz 5 safely to Earth. However, that was easier said than done. The main concern over Soyuz 5 return was anticyclonic conditions at the landing site, coupled with frigid temperatures hovering at close to minus 35 degrees C. The plan called for Voronov to manually orient Soyuz 5 for retrofire and make his landing at 9:30 a.m. Moscow time. After rehearsing the steps for this procedure during his final orbit, he reported he could not do it within the allotted 9 minutes. Nevertheless, he was told to try. Commands were also provided for a second automatic retrofire in the event that the manual effort failed. The intended retrofire time came at 8:48 a.m., but 8 minutes later, Voronov reported that he had been unable to complete the orientation manually, and controllers prepared to uplink the commands for an automatic burn on the next orbit. It would seem that weather conditions on the ground also contributed to the delay. Reentry finally got underway high above the Gulf of Guinea at 10:26 a.m., but soon it became alarmingly clear that the spacecraft was violently tumbling. Having already lost Vladimir Komarov during a bungled return to Earth 2 years earlier, it was obvious to the staff at Yevpatoria that another cosmonaut might very soon fall victim to the hazards of spaceflight. What was not known at the time, however, was that as the reentry began, Soyuz 5's instrument module was still securely attached to the descent module. For Voronov, the implications of this were potentially catastrophic. Under normal conditions, 6 seconds after retrofire, a series of pyrotechnics should have sheared the two apart, enabling the bell-shaped descent module to adopt its correct reentry orientation, with the heavy protected base of the descent module facing into the direction of travel to shield Voronov from the burn of 5,000 degrees C caused by frictional heat. For this very reason, the base was coated with a 6-inch thickness of ablative material, half of which was designed to char, melt, and peel away during reentry, thus safeguarding the descent module from the heat. Unfortunately, the final half hour of Soyuz 5 was far from normal. With the instrument module still in place, the base's thermal shield was covered and unable to fill its purpose. And worse still, the combined spacecraft was forced to adopt the most aerodynamically stable orientation, with the dome of the heavy descent module and its thin hatch facing into the direction of travel and about to feel the full force of searing hypersonic reentry. Unlike the base, the top of the descent module was coated with just an inch of ablator. Since the heat of reentry was predicted to char away at least 3 times as much off the base, a reentry in this altitude would likely end in catastrophe. At 10:32 a.m., Stockholm radio analyst Sven Gran and his colleague Chris Wood, based in Fiji, noted that shortwave communication signals from Soyuz 5 had abruptly stopped. An instant, normally assumed to be the time of separation of the instrument module, and in all probability, it was the time when the separation pyros fired. On his website, Gran noted that the electrical connection had been separated between the orbital and instrument modules, but not their mechanical connection. Aboard Soyuz 5, Voronov heard the pyrotechnics fire, but was stunned when he glanced through his window to see the solar panels and whip antennas of the steel-attached instrument module. According to Gran, the cosmonaut reported what he saw through a coded radio channel to ground controllers. When they realized what had happened, or more accurately, what had not happened, several flight controllers buried their faces in their hands. One officer removed his cap, dropped 3 rubles in it, and passed it along the line. Within minutes, it had filled with coins for Voronov's young family. Cosmonaut was effectively plummeting back to Earth, nose first, with the least protected section of his craft exposed to the greatest thermal stress. Moreover, he was exposed to G-forces in excess of 9 times their normal terrestrial load. Against such overwhelming odds, it seemed that Boris Voronov's fate was sealed. Not until 1996, almost 3 decades after the event, was Voronov finally able to speak publicly about what happened during that terrifying final half hour. Rather than being pushed back in his couch, as would be expected in a normal base-first reentry, Voronov was pulled outward against his harness. Yet, he still managed to repeat, "No panic, no panic," over and over again. In what he assumed would be the final minutes of his life, he continued to report his status into an onboard voice recorder and even tore the last pages from his rendezvous notebook, jamming them into his pockets in the vain hope that they might somehow escape incineration. From his couch, He could only watch helplessly as tongues of flame licked at the descent module's windows and washed over the cabin. The thin hatch directly in front of his eyes visibly bulged inward under the tremendous heat and pressure. All of Soyuz 5's hydrogen peroxide propellant had been expended shortly after the onset of reentry, when the automated system struggled fruitlessly to orient the descent module. Gradually, the intense heat, a heat which Volyanov clad only in a light flight garment rather than a pressurized suit could physically feel, began to melt the gaskets which sealed the hatch, and the cabin started to fill with noxious fumes. He clearly heard a roar as the propellant tanks in the instrument module exploded with such force that the crew hatch was forced inward and then upward like the bottom of a tin can. Together with a prolonged and disturbing grinding sound as the stress of deceleration took their toll on the unusual configuration. Finally, the struts holding the instrument module severed and the two modules separated, and the descent module offset center of mass caused it to assume a base-first orientation. It tumbled violently as it fell ballistic. The descent ended at 11:08 a.m. with a touchdown close to Orenburg, hundreds of miles off target in the snowy Ural Mountains. Despite having endured and survived one of the space program's most terrifying reentries, the cosmonaut's ordeal was not over. Heat damage and tumbling had caused the Soyuz 5 parachute lines to entangle, and as a result, their canopies only partially inflated. Moreover, one of the solid fuel soft landing rockets in the module's base failed to fire, resulting in a particularly hard touchdown. So hard, in fact, that Volyanov was torn from his couch and thrown across the cabin, breaking several teeth. As the noise and vibration of the last half hour was replaced by absolute silence, stillness, and bitter cold of a late winter morning in the Urals, he could reflect on how lucky he was to be alive. The temperature outside was close to minus 40 degrees C, and the superheated metallic surfaces of the spacecraft now hissed in the snow. Volyanov knew that he was far from his planned landing site and would have to wait several hours for rescue. On the other hand, spending hours in a Soyuz 5 in sub-zero conditions would mean certain death. He clambered outside and, spitting blood and bits of teeth into the snow as he went, set off in the direction of a distant column of smoke until he reached a peasant's cottage, where he took refuge, knowing that the rescue party would find the spacecraft and then follow the tracks of his boot prints and blood. Through a mouthful of broken teeth, the traumatized Volyanov had just four words for his rescuers. "Is my hair gray?" You would think the story ends there, but there is just a little more. On January 22nd, just 4 days after Volyanov's hard landing, the cosmonauts were placed in mortal danger again. Moscow wanted to honor the new heroes, and while the cosmonauts were traveling to the traditional Kremlin banquet from Vinnukovo Airport in a motorcade, right at the Kremlin's gates, someone hoping to kill Brezhnev fired on the motorcade. But he fired on the wrong vehicle. 8 shots were fired at the car carrying Beregovoy, Leonov, Nikolaev, and Tereshkova. Their driver was killed, and a motorcyclist in the motorcade escort received a minor injury. But the celebration at the Kremlin took place as if nothing had happened. In conclusion, for all the doubts over the validity of the space station claims, Soyuz 4 and 5 did become the first manned flight to exchange crew members in orbit. Had this daring and intensely risky mission been attempted as intended 2 years earlier, it would have cleared a major hurdle in the Soviet goal of reaching the moon. But by the end of 1968, Apollo 8 successfully orbiting of the moon made the joint flight of Soyuz 4 and 5 look to the rest of the world like a stunt and a mere shadow of what it might have been. Salutations from the foothills of North Carolina. This is Michael Annis, your host, and I wanted to say thanks for listening to episode 173 of the Space Rocket History Podcast, entitled Soyuz 4 and 5, The World's First Space Station, Part 2. Space Rocket History is a proud member of the History Podcasters and the Tech Podcasting Network. First of all, sincere apologies for mispronouncing those Russian names. And I want to give a big shout-out to all my longtime listeners. Thanks for staying subscribed, and extend a warm welcome to my new listeners. I'm glad you're here. And if you are a new listener, make sure you check out the webpage, spacerockethistory.com. There's a lot of information there, and you can sign up for the email alerts when there's a new episode, and follow me on Facebook and Twitter as well. So if you're new, go to the webpage, spacerockethistory.com. Today, we salute my moon emoji donors. These donors have donated for 3 years in a row. Thank you for your continued support, moon emoji donors. I had a few thoughts on this week's episode. First of all, last week, I made a mistake at a little past 28 minutes in the podcast when I was stating what the final mission plan for Soyuz 4 and 5 was. I said the wrong name for the commander of Soyuz 4. I said Beregovoy, and I should have said Shatilov. It's now fixed on the audio file, so if you want to re-download it, you can. And I apologize for making that mistake and not catching it. Okay, I want to congratulate the Soviets for executing the first docking of two manned spacecraft and crew transfer. They were the first in the world to do that. Now, I want to make sure I clearly explain the transfer of the cosmonauts between the vehicles. There were three cosmonauts launched in Soyuz 5. When the transfer was made, Voronov sealed himself in the descent module, and Krunov and Yelizaev left out of the orbital module. In other words, the orbital module was used as an airlock. I don't think Voronov even had a spacesuit, so he had to stay in the descent module. To me, the most confusing part was that the cosmonauts had to go outside to transfer between vehicles. There was no tunnel or hatch connecting the two Soyuz together. This really confused Western observers as well. And, of course, the Soviet Union was not going to clear things up for the Western observers. You can count on that. What about the statement Yelizaev made when he said, "The choice of the method of transfer through open space rather than by means of a tunnel was not an accidental one"? What did he mean by that? Is he saying the Soviets chose to take a risky spacewalk instead of transferring by going through a tunnel? They didn't have a docking tunnel. So it seems to me that was the only choice they had if they wanted to transfer. They had to do it on the outside. I'm thinking the purpose of that statement was to mislead. But I could be wrong, but that's what I think. What did you think about the Soviets' claim that they had created a space station with the docking of Soyuz 4 and 5? Now, since you have to go outside to get to the other half of the space station, and it didn't really stay stationary very long, it was like maybe between 4 and 5 hours, and then they undocked, that doesn't seem to be a space station to me. Now, the U.S. did not call the Apollo command module docking with the lunar module a space station. So, I'm kind of with Deke Slayton on this one. It would be quite a stretch to call two Soyuz docked together without a tunnel a space station. But your opinion may differ from mine, but that's kind of the way I feel. What about that return trip for Voronov? That was a catastrophe, narrowly avoided. And that module, the instrumentation propulsion module, it has stuck before coming back. So they still seem to have that problem. But overall, I totally enjoyed Soyuz 4 and 5. It was a really interesting and exciting mission. And congratulations to the Soviets for pulling that off. I've posted some pictures and, of course, the audio for this episode on my website, spacerockethistory.com. Go check that out, please. Now, for donations, I was pleased to receive 4 donations to support the podcast over the past week. Megan T. from California donated at the Vostok level and earned the rocket emoji. Carrie M. from Baltimore donated at the Soyuz level and has earned the rocket emoji. Joseph M. from South Carolina donated at the Vostok level. And Cameron B. from Australia donated at the Mercury level. Thank you very much, Megan, Carrie, Joseph, and Cameron. I appreciate it. Summer is a hard time for donations. They really seem to slack off. Now, our total on Patreons remained at the same. We're still at 65. And our overall donors for the year are 148, with a goal of reaching 250 by the end of 2016. So that's 102 more donors we would like to get by the end of 2016. So the dog days of summer are really a slow period. If you are able, and only if you are able, please donate to support the podcast. Now, it doesn't have to be a lot. You can make a one-time Sputnik-level donation for $5, or you can make a minimum donation of 50 cents per month on Patreon. If you think Space Rocket History is worth $5 a year or 50 cents in a month, then please donate. To make a one-time donation, you can go to the homepage, spacerockethistory.com, click on the orange donate button on the top right of the page, or you can sign up with Patreon by clicking on the Patreon link on the homepage, and it's located just below the orange donate button. And also, if you want to go directly to Patreon, you can type in patreon.com/spacerockethistory. All donors are rewarded with their name on the donors page on the website, spacerockethistory.com, based on their donation level. Donors that donate 2 years in a row receive the rocket emoji, and those who donate 3 years in a row receive the treasured moon emoji next to their name on the donors list. To stay updated on the podcast, including previews of the next episode, please follow me on Twitter. My handle is @SpaceRocketHist, and follow me on Facebook as well. The link for that is on the homepage. I was very pleased to see the podcast received another 5-star rating on iTunes this week. Want to thank Joe and Linda H. for the very kind review and the 5-star rating. Thank you very much. We're up to 116 ratings in iTunes now. I want to encourage everyone to share the podcast. Feel free to link the homepage or a particular episode on all social media. And thanks to those who have already done so, like my retweeters, Jet City Star, 1202 Alarm, Bert at Home, Bonner to You, Buddy P. Murphy, Cole Badger, David B. Nugent, Duke of Oil 60, Floppy Sasquatch, Flosen 26, Free Devil, Futurama King, Glenn Trudgett, Jacob Hahn, Janice Caxa, Kadavi 1202, Pompeiator, Rapid Mustang, RTDU 24, Skibby, Stephen Lebowski, Stiggy, This is Alex Boyd, Tomasino 1202. Hope I got everyone. If I didn't, just let me know and I'll get you next week. I really appreciate the retweets. This is the end of content for this episode, and I had a few off-topic thoughts. If you're not interested, please feel free to switch to the next podcast. Thanks for sticking around, folks. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Next week, we will stay in the USSR for a few episodes on the N1, including the February 1969 test launch. In podcast news, I have some new statistics for July that you haven't heard yet. These are the top 10 states in the United States for downloads of episodes. The top 10 for July 2016. Number 1, California. Number 2, Florida moves up to number 2. Texas drops to 3. Virginia moves up to 4. Illinois moves up to 5. Oregon at 6. Pennsylvania at 7. 8, the Old North State. 9, Washington. And 10, Michigan. And that is the top 10 states for downloads in July 2016. We're running a little long on this podcast, folks, so I'm going to close her out right there. Hope to have episode 174 up by next Thursday. And so long for now.